Thank you, my friends. The sun may have set over our city this evening, but as Eugene Debs once said, I can see the dawn of a better day for humanity.
I'm back again. Two episodes within a week, I think. Don't get too used to it, but I have been celebrating the victory of Zoran Mamdani here in the New York City mayor's race. One of the people I've been celebrating with is my friend Gino. Gino is a Lebanese political activist and blogger. He now lives here in the United States, and we've become pretty good friends over the last couple years. And Gino has also been canvassing with the Zoran campaign. In fact, he reminded me recently that Gino and I saw Zoran speak at a pro-Palestine demonstration back in 2021. So here's a conversation I had with Gino about our experience supporting the Zoran campaign and a little bit of analysis of what we think it means. So enjoy this. And check out all of the good work he does on his Substack called Gino's Blog. And in addition to writing, he also posts videos and audio podcasts. A lot of it focuses on Lebanese politics and what's happening in the Middle East. But he's also been starting to do some stuff about what's happening here in the United States as well. So check that out. And you can also find Gino on all of your social medias. He's very good at social media. In the meantime, please enjoy my conversation with Gino Raidi.
It's been a long journey for us, specifically us two, I think, when it comes to Zoran Mamdani. So maybe let's start there.
Long before we awoke in the trans-communist caliphate of New York, we were protesting. I guess we were going to a protest. Man, I guess it was against like a previous bombing of Gaza, wasn't it?
I believe it was when settlers were taking over Palestinian homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
Okay.
In the West Bank.
Yeah.
And it was like at the tail end of the COVID lockdowns.
So it was like 2021. Okay. Yeah.
So a group of folks gathered around Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn.
He
is a certain senator that did not endorse Zoran Mamdani. Lives there, and he is the biggest cheerleader of the dispossession of a lot of Palestinians and the continued occupation there. And one of those speakers was Zoran Mamdani,
yeah,
which was recent assembly member to the New York Parliament.
Yeah.
And I still remember he caught my attention. There were a few other speakers. I'm sure they were also great. But looking back into my archives, I noticed that I did take a 1-minute video of his speech that day, and a lot of it coincides so much with what his campaign was about, specifically about fighting the surge of anti-Semitism within the Palestinian Liberation Movement. So even since then, and despite all of that, he's been there.
All right.
So that is one when we met him, and it was completely unexpected, and we've been following him since then. And that kind of coincided with my arrival to the US almost, and the beginning of actually delving into what's going on in the U.S. It was an interesting time, for sure,
yeah,
for America. And you and I witnessed a lot of that together.
Yeah.
So looking back, having that information, did you ever consider that Zoran might be where he is today, that day when we saw him speak?
You know, you mentioned to me at some point over the last year that fact that we saw Zoran speak at that rally. And honestly, I didn't remember that. You, I think, you have a better memory than I do. What I remember about that rally was feeling like, oh, I'm so grateful that I'm wearing a mask right now, because I felt so like monitored and like, you know, vulnerable for taking this political position in a public way that I agree with but was tepid about. And I think it's also a sign of the political moment we're in now, how much things have changed since then, that now these are things we can like say and do without, I mean, you know, you still take professional and personal risks for these positions, as so many people have unfortunately suffered consequences from, But yeah, and like now there's a mayor, there's going to be a mayor of New York who spoke bravely at that time when doing that was not an easy thing to do. And through political circumstance, through, you know, what's happened in Gaza, and also through the Zoran campaign, the political climate has shifted significantly. It's kind of remarkable to remember. I mean, that was how I felt at that time. I felt scared being at that demonstration. And now I feel proud and happy to be surrounded by people, a majority of New Yorkers who elected someone who had staked out a moral position, you know, even when doing so was dangerous.
I love that you brought that up. I think Zohran represents that shift. And no matter how many people try to downplay that effect, I feel that it was a watershed moment. And what was happening in Gaza, the genocide, woke a lot of people up to maybe a reality some of us, but not enough of us, were already aware of. And I think everyone thought it would be something that would make it impossible for someone like Zohran to get where he was, when now we're looking at stuff where it's probably what didn't help Kamala get over the line. And it's actually what got, I think, till now the early numbers are where 30% of Jewish New Yorkers did go for Zohran, despite all the ads that were trying to paint him as something he was not, which is an anti-Semite. Going into that, let's talk about the Democratic Party.
Okay.
Personally, I felt very insulted by how a lot of the establishment, the old guard Democrats, have treated Zohran Mamdani's campaign. It felt like they were pretending he didn't exist, even though the media was hounding them, people were hounding them in their comments. The fact that the leadership barely endorsed him, and some of them even went on extremely racist triads on stuff like, I'm thinking about Kristen Gillibrand on Brian Lehrer's show on WNYC, and I couldn't believe it was 2025 and there was a Democratic senator in New York. As a person who isn't directly involved myself, for me it seems odd, because it seems like Zohran is the perfect package of everything the Democrats are missing. There's no excitement, young people are disenfranchised, they threw immigrants under the bus, they threw trans people under the bus, queer folk, they let abortion rights be rolled back. So Zohran seems like he checked all the boxes they haven't been able to, yet they've been so intent on trying to make him fail. Why do you think that was happening, and what does it mean that he won so resoundingly despite all of that?
Well, I think the Democratic establishment over the last 30 or 40 years has come to practice politics in a way that reflects that their existence as a political party really functions more as like a fundraising apparatus than it does like a political entity. And what I mean by that is, if you examine their motivations and the decisions they make and the stances they take, oftentimes what you'll find is that it reflects the interests of their donors. And so I think that a lot of the Democratic establishment has decided at times that it would be better to lose races. They want to have us believe that there's a pragmatism to their way of like triangulation and centrism. Like, we'll take these more moderated stances, quote unquote moderate stances. You're talking about things that I don't find to be moderate stances, like embracing Islamophobia or xenophobia. These are like far right stances. But if the corporate donors, or like, for example, the Israel lobby, or, you know, insurance companies or pharmaceutical companies are opposed to things that are popular to the vast majority of Americans, we've seen the Democratic establishment choose the side of where the corporate interest lies. And a lot of that has to do with the way campaigns in the United States are financed. You know, a presidential campaign might raise $1 billion with a B dollars. So if you're going to run, and the $1 billion then is going to get distributed to a bunch of consulting firms and strategists, and these are the people who are really making these decisions, you know? So one of the biggest challenges running a campaign in an environment like that is you have to really rise above the competition that has so much money behind it and so much institutional power behind it. And Zohran said last night, you know, like, we've defeated political dynasty. I mean, it's not just because Andrew Cuomo was the governor of New York and his father was the governor of New York. And in a lot of households in New York, his name is, the Cuomo name is like ubiquitous. You know, there's a bridge in New York with the Cuomo name on it. So yeah, there's generations of people who feel like the Cuomos are, you know, this great political force who's changed their lives for the better in some cases. So Zoran wasn't talking about just overcoming that political power. He also meant the dynasty in terms of the moneyed interests and the establishment that poured millions and millions of dollars into his campaign to defeat him. So I think that's a tremendous accomplishment. And why is it that the Democrats haven't been more forceful in supporting the person who won the Democratic nomination? It's because
by 13 points.
Yeah, he won the primary. It was not even close. And these are the people who were wagging their fingers at the left in 2016 and 2020 saying, you have to vote blue no matter who. Vote blue no matter who. Even if you don't like the nominee because, I don't know, it's Joe Biden or it's Hillary Clinton and you would have preferred Bernie Sanders, guess what? Your duty is to vote blue no matter who. All of a sudden, when the left wins the nomination, all of a sudden they're supporting a guy who lost the primary, you know, who's not a Democrat. I mean, who literally does not have the D next to his name on the ballot. And I think the reason why is because they think of their main function as a fundraising organization and not a political party that represents the interests of voters.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. I think it's how I feel as well, but I don't want to waste any more time on the old guard. I think that's enough for now. A lot of the people that will be listening to this are not living in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel lucky enough that we do, but I hear a lot of the rhetoric is that, oh, it's a fluke, it'll never work anywhere else, whether it's in this US or not. But the engagement I'm seeing from folks as far as New Zealand or Pakistan or everywhere is extremely energized about that. Personally, I'm seeing the kind of Zohran effect in places as far away as Michigan and Maine already. Other people are, you know, trying to downplay it. If you look at any of the major talking heads that go on TV, usually they're all pretending like, oh, it's just New York. I'm looking now at the New York Post of today. I had to go buy one.
It's a work of art, this cover. Google it if you haven't seen it.
I feel it's like AI, but let me describe it a bit. It's Zohran's face and what looks like a Soviet era style.
The hammer and sickle.
Of him holding a hammer and sickle and stars in the middle of what looks like something like Midtown Manhattan. And the caption says, on your marks, as in Karl Marx, get set, Zo, as in Zohran. Socialist Mamdani wins race for mayor of the Red Apple.
And then the R in red is backwards, like in Cyrillic. Because like in Cyrillic, writing the R.
Oh, I didn't even catch that. Okay. It's great. Okay, it makes sense now.
Work of art.
And the small blurb says, after a campaign that promised high taxes, free stuff, hating Israel and vibes, socialist Zohran Mamdani romped victory last night and will become the 111th mayor of New York City. Why are the moderates and the right-wingers having such a hard time figuring out why Zohran did so well at this moment in time? Like, it's so clear to the rest of us, I guess, maybe, or maybe is it in the hindsight that a lot of people now see it as clear? But how are they not seeing that it was their own policies and their own handling of what people actually wanted to do and what they wanted government to do is what led people to become democratic socialists, or at least be okay with the idea? Like, I doubt these people are reading Das Kapital and discussing it and decided to become Zohran Mamdani fans. They listen to his extremely clear platform that has enough precedents, that has enough data backing it up, and that has worked in other places, and thought like, yeah, that works for me. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what his foreign policy is. He's the guy that's going to run this city. And they just can't wrap their heads around it. So what would we tell folks outside of New York City what they could take away from Zohran's and try to repeat it in their own community?
I was asked this question recently on that Wastun, the German podcast that you introduced me to. I think there's two important pieces of context. Besides Zohran's sort of generational talent as a communicator, and besides the fact that his rise came out of a movement that has worked for several years now to establish, you know, democratic socialist politics in New York specifically, and policy platforms that would have a broad appeal in the city. Separating those things for a second, the other important pieces of context are global neoliberalism, which I do think is a phenomenon all over the world that is that has very stark failures and very stark consequences that hurt people. And then the other one, in the case of the United States, is Donald Trump. You know, like, we're 1 year into, well, less, but we're in the first year of a Donald Trump presidency. And I think that is scary. And it's already, like, devastating the lives of thousands of people here and causing a lot of chaos. So those two things cause, like, I think are opportunities that people either elsewhere in the United States or around the world, depending on their, you know, local political context, can sort of pick up on and use to their advantage. And I'd say, like, perhaps the more universal circumstance is that of, like, neoliberalism and hyper-financialization. And what I mean by that really is, like, you know, not to make it seem like it's this very abstract thing that we ideologically oppose because we're leftists. What I mean is, you know, jobs that used to provide families with a somewhat comfortable lifestyle, where they could afford their housing, where they could afford to go out to dinner occasionally, where they could afford to take a few weeks off in the summer and go to the beach. Increasingly, people all over the world are realizing they can't afford housing in the cities where they live. The jobs that they used to have that provided for, like, a somewhat comfortable middle class existence are disappearing. The corporate, you know, private equity companies and hyper-financialization are causing all sorts of chaos in, like, the job market, in the way we communicate with each other, like, on social media. And so these are all, like, phenomenons. These are all phenomenon that manifest in different ways in different places. But there's consequences that are very tangible and concrete in people's lives. And I think what the Zoran campaign did from day one, you know, we talk about his position on Palestine because that was the position that first caught our attention. But when you look at, like, the launch of this campaign and what has been the central focus of this campaign, it's really very concrete economic proposals that the campaign has put forth, like making buses free, like free childcare, like freezing the rent on rent stabilized apartments. These are very basic, very simple proposals that are very easy for people to understand, that are very attractive because, like, for example, in New York City, if you have a kid who's under the age of 4 or 5 and they can't go to kindergarten, you might be spending like $15,000 a year on childcare. So if you're making $75,000, $85,000, $90,000, you're trying to pay rent. Like, childcare suddenly is like, what, more than, you know, 15% or 20% of your income, and that's crippling for a lot of families. So that sort of proposal that's so simple and so transformative in people's lives, those are the sorts of things I think people can apply here. Like, people can look at this campaign and say, like, you know, what is it that could be proposed in my city or in my state or in my country, where people are feeling squeezed, and working and poor people in particular, who are the vast majority of people in the world, where can their lives be improved? Where is somewhere that government can make things easier for people to have a dignified life? You identify those things, you find very simple proposals, not something that's very convoluted and complex that involves means testing and it involves you know, like, a threshold where, like, if you make $75,000 a year, you get it. If you make $75,001, then you don't get it. And now all of a sudden you have half of the people who hate the people who make a little bit less than them because they get a free thing. No, don't do that. Do things that are universal. Do things that are simple. Do things that are easy to understand.
And it'll cost you less bloat and bureaucracy, you know, of people having to verify all the asterisks they add to stuff. When it's universal, it's people who need it more. They will be able to access it without having to jump through many hoops.
Of course, some of these people, they love to think of themselves as, like, people who embrace efficiency in government, you know? But a lot of the times these programs, they're actually not as efficient for the reasons you're saying. And I think to some of these politicians, they don't really mind that, because what's more important is that the program have this political vulnerability, that the program not be, like, supported by everyone in the base so that they can constantly be offering things and taking them away, you know?
Let's move into a book you had recommended to me, which was Why We Burn by an author called
Vincent Bezant.
Yeah. I liked it a lot, especially after what we had gone through in Lebanon and a lot of other countries in the 2010s and late 2010s, where huge popular uprisings mostly failed eventually, whether it's as far away as Chile to Hong Kong and everywhere in between. I noticed something that I hadn't before, maybe because popular mobilization and protesting has been such a part of my teen years and adult life in Lebanon, where that's a fairly new thing, because before media existed, you'd be only protesting to the people who could see you within their eyesight, so and with their eye range of their eyesight. And I feel that that's been tied to a lot of why these popular feelings and what is obviously true and you could feel when you are in the streets during those popular uprisings never really translated into reality. I feel the secret sauce that Zohran had was the DSA members, the Democratic Socialists of America members, who were the people on the ground, the people organizing the 100,000 volunteers that were able to knock on millions of doors and do millions of phone calls. So it made me realize that in a lot of places, this is lacking, where there's an organized, it doesn't have to be a majority of folks, but enough folks that are organized enough, they know each other enough, each of them have a specific set of abilities or experience or expertise, and they know what they should do with it and when to actually deploy it and all that stuff. How important is it to have things that go beyond the performative part, like demonstrations, and actually do the stuff that doesn't sound that glamorous, whether it's like we were both like heaving and huffing and puffing, like every 5-6 floor walk-ups, we had to go to knock on doors. And I'm thinking like, why the hell are we doing this, you know, on a Sunday night instead of just kicking back or enjoying something or going to a bar or going out? Like, why the hell are we going to do this now? And at the moment, I'm like, but this is actually what's going to matter, because at least personally, in a lot of the neighborhoods I went to, I feel like sometimes folks just have no clue. And we tend to forget that when we're that into this medium and politics and news. Some people just have no clue. They don't watch TV. The algorithm is catered just to them. So a lot of people didn't even know. A lot of people know some parts, but not enough to have a full picture.
Yeah.
I remember you telling me about like some guy really loved Zohran Mamdani, but didn't know when the election was.
Yeah.
You know, and there was these missing pieces. So maybe we can reflect a bit on the excitement of thinking leaderless and horizontal movements are actually nice. And I, speaking from Lebanon, I say that because leaderless sounds nice, because leaders that are good are often immediately killed by a car bomb or assassinated. It's been usually like Syrian regime, Hezbollah, the usual culprits. So in our mind, having it leaderless, at least in my personal opinion, was a good thing.
Yeah.
But that's when things started going downhill, because if there's no organization and we're not exactly sure why we're there, and here I'm going to quote something from Star Wars series Andor, where everyone has their own rebellion. Like a lot of people are there for different reasons that affect their lives,
yeah,
their material lives directly, as you mentioned earlier, like how it can be adapted. What is the key takeaways from what the DSA did, and why is that important?
It's a great question, and I think I think answering your question, like why is door knocking or things like door knocking, like why is that so effective or why is that so important, you know? I saw last night something like the Zohran campaign said they had 100,000 volunteers by the end of the campaign. Maybe not every single one of those people is from New York. It's possible. But when you consider that this is a city of, you know, 8.5 million people, like now you're talking about like more than 1% of the city, or, you know, maybe you eliminate some of them because maybe some of them came from other cities or states, but something like 1% of the city, volunteered at some point or another for the campaign. That's remarkable. And I think that just showing your neighbors, like I think COVID, in addition to the phenomenon you're describing about, you know, people going back to like the aughts, being captivated by things they're seeing on their phone, and then the failure to translate that enthusiasm or those movements into like actual political gains. I think that COVID also like distorted and accelerated that process to some degree. And you saw that in 2020 here. You know, there were people who poured out into the streets in 2020. But yeah, one of the big flaws is that there was no specific ask. I mean, there were some specific asks that never were implemented, like ending qualified immunity or, you know, like those sorts of changes to the criminal justice system. For the most, there were some changes on some local levels, but really, like, by and large.
Or they would implement them, then, like, a few months later, like, oh, it's not working, and yeah, then repeal it. I'm like, you need some time to figure out if it worked or not.
Or one guy goes to prison, you know? Like, Derek Chauvin went to prison, the guy that killed George Floyd. I mean, that's what should have happened anyway, but that is not a structural political change that people were asking for. I think that one of the things that was really effective about the DSA was, you know, basically, I think Zoran came from the DSA, you know, he was a member of the DSA. He had worked on DSA campaigns prior to running for office. So he's what they call like a cadre, you know, like he came from within. He was a member who decided to run. And that meant that as soon as he decided to run, and I think that also like the DSA and Zoran played this like game of footsie before they officially announced that they were endorsing him, where he basically said, like, I don't really want to run unless I get endorsed. And they were like, okay, well, like, but are you going to run? And he's like, are you going to endorse me? And eventually, yes, like they endorsed him and he ran. And immediately they had like an army of people ready to do these things we're talking about, knocking on doors, so that the activation of the campaign involved not just like a message, but also like a human connection, which I think, as I was saying, like during COVID, we were all sort of missing, you know? And so being face to face with people and showing your neighbors that you care enough to, you know, my mom really doesn't like it that I do the door knocking because like you kind of have to sometimes sneak into buildings. Like maybe they think you're delivering a package or someone's like going into their building and there's in my neighborhood, there's really no doorman building. So the door opens and maybe someone's coming in or out and you sort of catch the door in a sneaky way and you go in and you have your app and you know which doors you're supposed to knock on and you knock on them. My mom's like, that's kind of like dangerous. And like, is that legal? You know? When you're showing your neighbors, I care enough about this thing to do this task, which is a huge pain in the ass. And it is sometimes uncomfortable. I mean, me and you are like not really very shy people, but a lot of the DSA members are, as we were talking about, you know, and for them to like get out of their comfort zone and go sneak into someone's building and knock on their door while they're making dinner and interrupt whatever they're doing in their apartment to just say, I'm here as a volunteer. I'm not getting paid for this. I really believe in this candidate. I really believe in this campaign, and you should too. That has a tremendous amount of power. It's way more effective than someone like watching a video or two on Instagram. I think, like, you know, you were mentioning the Vincent Bevins book, and I love that book. And like one of the, you know, one thing that I think was like reflected in the Egyptian Revolution that perhaps is like a cautionary tale, but it's worth noting, you know? Like when Egypt was going to hold this election for the first time after the fall of Mubarak, like who was there that instantly had this entire political network that had like an army of people ready to...
Muslim Brotherhood.
It was the Muslim Brotherhood. Like they were the one...
Mutual aid, all that stuff.
The mutual aid. They got to get to the residents in the neighborhoods, the activation of thousands and thousands of people. So it's not really like a coincidence that they're the ones that came out on top of that lack of on that horizontal and lack of hierarchical,
even though it wasn't maybe them that instigated that popular uprising, it was active or the more net or labor unions, even, you know, things that they were the only ones ready enough to seize that opportunity when it presented themselves to unfortunate circumstances, right?
Sure. But
shout out to everyone in Egypt.
Yeah, big shouts to my homies over in Masr. But I think... I love Cairo, one of my favorite cities. Masr Omadonia to all.
Layak ya basha, like Zohran said in his ads.
But I think that like the reason why I point that out is because what you're talking about of this like lack of, you know, this horizontalist, leaderless, more anarchic movement, they can be useful and they can be disruptive, you know? They can even take down a government. They can even take down...
We took down 4 in 1 year in Lebanon.
Yeah, there you go. You know, like, you're able to take down the government. But then the question is like, well, now what? You know, like, it can provide its own set of dangers and risks because if you don't have an organization and you don't have a platform and you don't have a plan of what you're going to do with power and what you're sort of asking of people who are a part of your movement, then you're perhaps vulnerable to those sorts of opportunists, you know?
If you're not going to speak for yourself, someone else is going to come speak for you.
Yeah.
And a way that I saw that manifest very clearly in Lebanon was most of the media there is like owned by someone in the establishment. So they all have like a clear agenda where you know what they're trying to do. The good thing is that like most of them have TV stations, so you can watch the whole collection and kind of find the middle ground to figure out what the reality actually is. But a lot of their coverage of what was happening was just sending a camera crew and putting up a microphone and any random person coming and saying whatever they want, you know, whether it's a troll, whether it's someone who has a very specific thing about like social security for seniors, whether it's someone who is against the sectarianism and wants like radical reform. So everyone had it, and they would use each of the things to attack what wasn't convenient for each specific side that owns that station. So it was such a clear manifestation of that. And one of the nice things, or at least personally what I enjoyed the most about when we would canvass, when I would canvass in places, was that after we're done, we'd all like go for a happy hour at the local bar, which also supports Zohran Mamdani. And you'd see the connections being made by those volunteers. And like most of them were not even DSA members. So they're just people who want to get involved. And DSA just happens to be the folks that, you know, tell them what to do or point them in the right direction, give them the details they need to do to know where to go and who to knock, which doors to knock, stuff like that. But a lot of them like were random folks. And I realized, especially for the younger generation that spent most of their formative years like in COVID and in lockdowns and on social media completely instead of us, where we kind of had the luxury of remembering the time before that was the thing, but also growing up within social media. So I feel pretty lucky to be like in both of these things. But I realized how important those sometimes inconvenient things like door knocking were, especially for folks that didn't have that opportunity. Like I've partnered up with a lot of younger Gen Zers that just could not strike up a conversation that made people comfortable. You know, it's like two guys knocking on someone's door and then looking at their phone to read the name that they can't pronounce properly without introducing themselves first. You know, I'm like, you know, dude, like no one like knocks on anyone's door anymore. And if like two guys open up, there's like a way to open a conversation to know that you're not a threat first and to see how you can approach this, this topic of trying to convince them to vote for Zohran in a way. So that's where I'm like, this is the beauty of this, or the importance of this that no one ever mentioned.
Well, it's, you know, the outreach or the learning really like goes two ways, doesn't it? Because especially if you're on the left, like you are purporting to be a part of a movement that's supposed to benefit poor and working people. So you kind of like a very important part of that, effort is to be able to connect with and interact with poor and working people if you're not one of them, you know? So that to me is like, yeah, it's a useful thing in terms of getting people to vote for Zohran Mamdani, but it's also like a useful thing in terms of building a movement where, you know, like maybe you're a young Zoomer, maybe you went to school, maybe you're college educated, and you know, you have political interests and passions. But to put them into practice as a left-wing person, it's incredibly educational to then have to like go actually talk to the people who you think that you, and I don't mean you, Zohran, I mean you, Gino or Russ or whoever, whatever like low-level campaign volunteer, to go speak with those poor or working-class people who you purport to represent as a part of a political movement and interact with them, listen to them. Learn how to engage with them. And that is as educational and informative for the person doing the canvassing as it is for the person who you're canvassing, I think, sometimes, you know?
What I love about Zohran's campaign is that it wasn't in studios at first. At the end, it was in studios. The first video where I'm like, this campaign is different, was him speaking to a guy that has a halal food truck about how much chicken over rice costs. And it's like $9 now or $10. And then he explains that to be able to have one of those halal carts and trucks that if you've ever been to New York, I'm sure you've seen, usually it's like Egyptian folks. And I'm always happy to get like refuel after a night out or as soon as I get to the city with someone and listen to maybe some Amrou Diab on their portable speaker. But what I found out is through that Zohran Cup ad was that the license from the city costs like $200 only. But there's a limited number. So there's a select few people that actually have access to those licenses to be able to, permits, I mean, to be able to open these halal trucks. And it reminded me of the taxi medallion thing that Zohran is famous for when he went on a hunger strike after many like cab drivers in New York were literally killing themselves because they were so deep in debt because of other mayors' plans about what to do. And for me, it was so interesting to see how like everyone's had like a gyro or a chicken and lamb or combo when they're like hungry and nothing else is open at night in the city. But to link it to so many different policies that the city is actually involved in, and then turned it into, if we can streamline this, we can make halal $8 again instead of it being 10. So I'm like, this is actually like, it matters to a lot. It matters to me. It matters to a lot of people where, one, you feel these small business owners, these entrepreneurs really, and the biggest city on earth for this kind of stuff, how stacked against them the system is, and how it's a small group of elites that are just benefiting off the scarcity that's manufactured, where if it was a city that wanted to fix that, it was so easy to give a lot more people opportunity to do that. There'd be more competition, the quality would improve, and everyone would be better for it. So for me, like, who would have ever thought that this was a good political move? But I wouldn't even have thought it. I'm like, oh, that's cute. He likes halal food and he's trying to make a thing. But then I'm like, wow, this is like a whole policy proposal. And he went into all of it in such a nice and approachable way.
Yeah.
That made it like real, like maybe most of the permits and stuff we'll never need to do as like regular human beings living in this.
Well, that's another shout out, right? To the Arab Spring, right? Like, wasn't it in Tunisia, the very beginning of it? I mean, I think there's like a universal appeal to these ideas and policies that you're saying. Like you're saying, it's like the butterfly flaps its wings in the forest and it causes like a chain reaction and all sorts of like bigger and more dynamic impacts than like ripple through the entire ecosystem that is a city. But also, like, I think it goes back to what I was saying before about like finding very, so maybe simple or maybe kind of, they would seem, if you're like engaged in politics, like especially national or international politics, you think about something like that and you think like, that's such a small idea. That's not like, creating like a new commercial center or like some sort of like new housing project where you're going to create like thousands of apartments. It's kind of a simple and seemingly like superficial idea. But those are the sorts of ideas that A mayor has the ability to do, and B, like...
And it's like on every corner, you know? It's not like it's not ubiquitous. Like, everyone would feel the effect in one way or another.
I mean, I'll tell you who probably wouldn't feel the effect of those sorts of things.
Folks that aren't walking on the street.
Yeah.
Being driven around.
Yeah, people who are like billionaires who are just like, they don't even like buy groceries, you know what I mean? Like, they're just existing in a completely different way. So, yeah, I think it was very creative the way he came up with these proposals that were very like grassroots and reflected the lives of the vast majority of people who live in the city.
A moment in this campaign I really liked was 10 days ago, maybe, or a couple of weeks ago, there was a huge rally for Zohran in Forest Hill Stadium in Queens.
Hmm.
And it had Bernie Sanders on it and the AOC as well. And I remember, like, I think most of us, or at least a lot of the people listening, probably heard about democratic socialism because of Bernie's 2016. You probably knew that beforehand, but it became into like the public awareness for a lot of folks, myself included, in 2016. And for me, it felt like very interesting to imagine that as like a 25-year-old back then, hearing about Bernie and how he was kind of treated and how it was always like pie in the sky considered, or to see like surrounded by 14,000 folks and kind of like his two successors in a way, and where they've actually reached to, it felt like embodiment of how far the idea that you can't just keep surviving on small band-aids and like trying to maintain a system that's obviously leaky and cranky. And like you said, sometimes a lot of people fall through the cracks. You need to like have a better idea and not just be against something. And to me, it felt like a bit of vindication. It felt nice to be surrounded by so many like-minded individuals and to see how much that movement has grown here and how good of an ambassador or like an example of that was Zohran Mamdani's campaign. So what do you feel like 2016 versus 2025, the kind of movement that's happened now where I see them as like the movers and shakers now, like not the establishment temps. You know, I don't see Cuomo having dozens of watch parties sold out all over New York City. I don't see like leadership in Congress getting people out to gymnasiums in the middle of nowhere in Iowa, where like a third of the population comes out to hear them talk, where Bernie did the whole tour of West Virginia, stopped in every single county there to speak to them. And those people came out, even though we're always told that, no, you need to only like Joe Manchin there. You, these kinds of folks, you cannot hope for a better future or a better deal for yourself. How is that doing, you think, now? And anticipating how much pushback it's going to come from people benefiting from the current arrangement, what are the obstacles it's going to face and how will it overcome them, you think?
Well, I will say this. I'm a bit older than you. So I see what's happening now as a part of a movement that goes back way before 2015 and 2016. To me, and I'll say this also, maybe this is encouraging if you're in a place like Lebanon. If you're like on the left or you're progressive or whatever, you know, you're invested in human dignity in whatever way that manifests itself, you're probably going to be in the losing position a vast majority of the time. You know, you're going to lose a lot for a long time. And the wins are going to come eventually, hopefully, but they're going to be fewer and far between than if you have a more status quo sort of mainstream political position. So I have seen, like, my first foray into left-wing politics was, you know, well, one of them was like protesting the Iraq War, the Iraq War of 2003, when it began. And at that time, you know, like, yeah, there was a somewhat sizable protest movement, but I think there was like, you could count on one hand the number of people in Congress that were voting against the invasion of Iraq. And it seemed like such a fringe position. Like, we were really in a minority if you just analyzed like the political rhetoric and what the politics of the moment reflected at the time. Then there was Occupy Wall Street. Like, I see that as like another important plot point on the left progressive movement in the United States, like the modern one anyway. And Occupy Wall Street was a very horizontalist, leaderless, objectiveless movement. But I do think, and even though it sort of failed for whatever that means, like there was no like concrete political achievements that came directly from Occupy Wall Street. But there was language from Occupy Wall Street that made its way into that 2015 Bernie Sanders primary campaign. Like, for example, the 99% versus the 1%. I mean, that was like directly lifted from the mouths of people protesting during Occupy. And from 2016 until now, I mean, we've seen like the further degradation of people's economic well-being here in the United States. There's like an infinite number of indicators that reflect that. We've also seen now we're in the second Trump administration. So like the misery and suffering at the hands of the right and at the hands of unbridled capitalism, I think, has grown and worsened in the United States. But which I think is, you know, these things are not like happening in isolation from one another. The rise of this new like leftist populist political movement and the worsening of like people's material circumstances. But it is, like I said, when you have the political beliefs that I do, you're losing like almost all of the time. To see Zohran Mamdani win last night was like transcended for me. I mean, it was like surreal. Besides the fact that he gave, I think, what is the best political speech of my lifetime. I feel comfortable saying that. Like, I've been thinking about it ever since last night. Obama gave a very good speech at the 2004 Democratic Convention. He also gave a pretty good acceptance speech in 2008. But I don't think it really I don't think it touches the speech that Zoran gave last night.
I think Zoran's speech last night, what made it so special is how honest it was.
Yeah.
It was not written by experts who have polled what people like and what don't. It wasn't like ChatGPT'd into it where it just like does the common denominator of what the establishment probably thinks this is what you should do.
Yeah.
And it shows, like, when you see Pete Buttigieg or Cory Booker or any of those establishment, like, out of, you know, they take them out of an assembly line of they all think the same thing, where they openly say, like, I'm not going to talk about this until the polls, mm-hmm. the opinion polls change. I'm like, dude, like, you have the ability to change this political polls. You are a lawmaker. You are a producer yeah. in power. So it never even occurs to them. So that's what felt so refreshing in Zohran's acceptance speech or victory speech, at least. And how much Arabic there was in it.
Oh, I'm very happy about that.
Well, you know, people were saying, like, the sort of mainstream pundits were saying, like, oh, he was defiant, you know. And they were saying this like it was a bad thing. Like, oh, you know, he wasn't the unifying sort of making some sort of gestures of
unify with the people that yeah. are blaming, accusing you of like coming to do a terrorist attack on all of them just because of you're not like, you know, your genetics aren't what they wanted to be and you didn't swear fealty to like an entity committing a genocide. Like, why?
How dare you? How dare you?
And I know we spent like $22 million like attacking you and your person and your family and everything about you, but now you're the one that should be like, yes, to me. I'm like, come on. I'm like, the first time it's someone who's actually honest, and I agreed with everything.
I mean, to me, that was like, I voted for Obama twice, and in retrospect, I think Obama was, he came up short, and I don't think he was a good president for that reason, because he had a unique opportunity to accomplish a lot of progress, and which is what I thought he was campaigning on. And I think in retrospect, he never really meant to do those things that I thought he was going to do. I think he wanted people like me to feel excited enough to vote for him. And then he was happy to basically just like sort of go with the status quo. And I think Zoran, when you look at his campaign and you look at that speech last night, what I see is a sort of correction from the Obama era political strategy, where instead of trying to, you know what a Rorschach test is? It's like that test that psychologists do that's like splotches on a paper, and like they, you know, everyone sort of has their own interpretation of what they're looking at. And I think like the Obama strategy for like political rhetoric had been mostly a Rorschach test, like give people some reason to think that you're reflecting their dreams and desires and values, you know, and then they can sort of like take away what they want. And then that's it. And you basically just do the status quo stuff. And I think Zoran was very clear. He was very clear in his campaign, and he was very clear in that speech last night. And he was very I thought he was sort of unifying. He said, you know, like, I'm going to be a mayor for all New Yorkers, even people who voted for my opponents. And like he referenced some of the things that people said they were concerned about, probably in bad faith, in my opinion, like the anti-Semitism stuff. But he referenced it and he mentioned it, and he said he wanted Jewish New Yorkers to feel safe and all this stuff. But ultimately, like, what these more mainstream pundits and analysts wanted was for Zoran to seem like he was coming to them with his hat in his hand, you know? Like he was coming in a more submissive way and saying like, okay, I've won. And now like, what is it? How are we going to like collaborate and do this thing together? What he's saying instead is like, I have a coalition. We won. I'm going to do the things I promised that I was going to do. And I'm going to do it in a way that is going to be respectful of democratic norms and of people who feel differently and who didn't vote for me. And we're all going to benefit as a result of that.
And if you want to help and make that a reality, that he's ready to work with them on, and which I think is important. You know, you shouldn't take away from what you believe in, and like the fantasy that you're gonna attract people who don't support you. Like Democrats have been, I feel, campaigning for suburban Republicans for like 20 years now, and like convinced that they're gonna switch sides for them, and that's never worked for them. And in so doing, I feel like they abandoned a lot of their core constituencies that Zoran has brought back to the fold, I feel. You know, because if you sell out everyone because you think some, you know, like that mythical couple Chuck Schumer imagines every time he wants to make a decision.
Yeah.
That lives in Long Island and they're the wealthy white couple, or I don't know what the idea he created of.
Yeah.
When you ditch like labor unions at places like West Virginia, who were always like literally the core of everything you do, it's not obviously a winning strategy. And you can run maybe once, twice, maybe three times against an agenda like they did successfully sometimes, unsuccessfully most of the time. But eventually it wears off. You know, people are don't know what you want. I still can't articulate what Kamala Harris was running.
But look at
Zohran, you can people can repeat it during his speech. And I've been to several of those.
Yeah.
Where he would say like,
freeze
we're gonna
the
first and for buses. Freeze the rent. You know, like it's so simple and everyone knows. And no matter how much they try to make it about another subject, he's so masterful at like bringing it back to those issues.
Yeah. So but look at what he's doing now with like Kathy Hochul. The governor of New York is by no means a left-wing person. I was not a huge fan of Kathy
Hochul. It was very nice to see her at the Forest Hills rally where she couldn't even talk because everyone was like yelling, text the rich, as she said she wasn't going to, kind of. And Zohran had to come on stage to like calm everyone down and like eventually she like agreed, yeah, we're going to text the rich. So that moment was my favorite at that rally.
But, you know, people are saying like people on the left, they're not pragmatic. They're not thinking about how to implement these things that they're promising. Zohran doesn't have the ability by himself to raise taxes on anyone. He's the mayor of New York. In order to pass the free bus program, he's going to need the involvement of the state government in Albany. Okay. Now, how is it that he's going to do that? Well, a big part of it is Kathy Hochul is going to run for re-election. And she knows that Zohran is a tremendously popular political figure in New York. That's why she came to campaign for him. That's why she endorsed him. Because she knows that her political future is in a way tied to Zohran's goodwill with her. And maybe Zohran is going to make a deal. Maybe Zohran is going to say to her, look, you help me do the bus thing. You help me with some of these other policies that are going to involve perhaps increasing taxes on wealthy people in New York. You help me with that, and I'm going to make sure the DSA doesn't run a primary challenge against you in your reelection campaign. And I'm going to say that I endorse you, but you have to play ball. So this idea that it's like the centrists and the moderates that are the ones that know how to like get things done and have practical solutions, I think it's bullshit. Like, look at Zohran. This is like one of the most tactical maneuvers you can imagine in politics. And he hasn't even taken the mayor's office yet.
I think, I think also Hochul made like the rest of New York's Democrats, old guard, like she was smarter than all of them. She saw the writing on the wall. She saw where the party was actually going, the people who make up the party, and like jumped ship, I guess, and took the plunge and actually endorsed Zohran. And he hasn't endorsed her yet, too.
Yeah.
Which is notable to say, though. And you see, like, other leaders who waited for him to win to, like, kind of congratulate him, but not really. And, like, did everything they could to trip him up. So I feel like she took a politically smart decision for her own future. Especially that she's already been, I think, getting some challenges from more left-wing folks.
Yeah.
Like Delgado, I think, or I forgot his name. But yeah, I think she felt that, okay, the old party of maintaining everything exactly the same and not even thinking about making life a tiny bit better for most folks, you know, wasn't going to run anymore.
I think it's a reflection of like how successful Zohran is going to be is what his ability to deliver on these things that we're talking about, right? These things that are the core of his campaign, the economic proposals, the free buses, the free childcare, the freezing the rent. These are complex things that are going to involve political maneuvers. They're going to involve coalition building and making deals with people who aren't necessarily a part of Zohran's coalition. And I think it's very encouraging to see that he's thinking about this and maybe even like making some of these moves now, because his future political viability is going to depend on his ability to deliver on these.
I feel that with him, that he's not coming like to prove something right or wrong. He's coming to implement the ideas he has, and whatever will get him to be able to do that without compromising on the core he's willing to do. And I feel that's very refreshing versus, you know, always needing everyone to be completely aligned 100% ideologically, morally, ethically, blah, 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 on everything to be able to work with them. And I think that's a good example to set where even if he and Hochul are not, don't agree on a lot of other things, there are a few things they could work on. And I think that's what we want to see in folks that are actually trying to govern, not just the ones, you know, trying to set, to comment on stuff or imagine a better world, but actually implement the ideas they had. Russ, I think this is one of the longest episodes I've done so far, but
sorry.
I feel like, no, I'm not at all. I'm very happy we did. I think it's very important, like a few hours after we saw the results, just to take take stock of where we're at and pause a bit, maybe look at this after Zohran comes into office and revisit how he was doing. But yes, thank you so much. If you have anything you'd like to say to folks listening, I know my New York audience is growing, mm-hmm. but a lot of folks are going to be in Lebanon or the Lebanese diaspora right now.
Well, merci to all of you and shukran, although Gino tells me you don't say shukran in Lebanon, but shukran regardless, and sabah al fol, and ishta, cream cheese. I wish you all a cream cheese afternoon. And follow
first
me.
First time someone ishta says.
Follow me on social media if you don't already. Russ Finkelstein.
And listen to Russ's podcast as well.
And listen to my podcast, The New Yorker Political Scene, which is mostly about me making fun of the political analysis of The New Yorker magazine, but also talking to people like Gino.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Russ.
Thank you. I love you.
I love you too. That was great.
All right.